join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend. And today we got a good group of folks on, and we're going to be chatting about a topic that has interested me for a while and is interested in growing, I think, in its attention, especially in the outdoor hunting world, so and fishing too. So excited to see that. We're gonna be talking about lead-free ammo, North American lead, non-lead partnership, and that, of which two of my guests are members in. So I will give a quick update, and then we've got Colin and Corey here. We'll see what they've been up to, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty. You guys, Leland and Chris, please feel free to jump in, laugh, comment, question, concerns, anything while we're chatting through our updates. All good. So let's see. News for me since last podcast. So I guess I'll go into it. So doing a little bit of trout fishing at some of the lakes and rivers around here. So pretty excited about that. And been doing a lot of research on dry aging fish, and so that's what I did last week. I dry aged some trout and then turned around and put it on the grill, and I used our new soon to be released wild fish seasoning on it as I put it on the grill. Let me tell you, I was very interested in this aging process. There's a chef in Australia who's big into whole fish butchery and treating fish as meat versus looking at it as like its own separate entity. So he's like, well, if we dry age meat, why not dry age fish? So he's gotten big into that. Josh Nyland is his name, if you want to look him up. Trying to get him on the podcast. So Josh, if you're listening, fair chance you may be. We'd love to have you on the show. but no, it motivated me because he does a lot with mostly saltwater fish, and because he's Australia based, a lot of fish based in Australia and that part of the world. But I was like, you know what, if you can dry age seafood, sea saltwater fish, goodness. And you know, people cure and smoke salmon and cure and smoke trout. Like, what if we did a bit of a dry age on a trout? And so I left the trout whole. I gutted it, cleaned it out really well, put a paper towel on the inside to kind of collect any of the moisture buildup, and then I put it uncovered in the fridge on a wire rack and let it set for about 3 or 4 days. And then, on that fourth day, it was great. Even still, like, I smelled it, kind of did the test the texture, all that stuff. Like, no really alarming sounds, you know, from a culinary background that's like, oh, this fish is bad, like, I shouldn't eat this. And so then fired up the old pellet smoker, threw it on there at 500, let it grill up nicely after rubbing it down with some of our new spice blend. And man, I was impressed. It was buttery, more buttery than I've ever had a trout before. And my wife said that to her, it tasted a lot like salmon, which I thought was really interesting. So pretty cool process. I think I'm going to put together a piece on my thoughts and go into a little more detail, but definitely fun. And then this week, heading up to the mountains to do some fly fishing up in some of the alpine streams and lakes. I'm going to take my Tenkara fly rod up there and hit it up. But also, too, we just kicked off the summer magazine project. So we'll be working. We just brought in a new in-house designer, Seth, who's going to be helping us work through that. And also pretty excited, we brought on two advertising folks, Jason Luna and Stu. Those fellas are going to be working through helping us fill some ad space in the magazine and stuff like that. So super excited about that. If you know anybody who wants to do some advertising, send them our way. And then, as always, I mentioned earlier the spice blend, but we've got the pig camp coming up in December. Super excited about that. We're already starting to fill some slots, so if you're interested in coming to hunt wild pigs with us and learn how to shoot, hunt, process, butcher, cook wild pigs in like a three-day weekend, be sure to go over to the website and sign up because those seats are selling fast. There's only 12 of them, and we've already sold several, so check that out. And with that, we'll go over to you, Colin.
Hey, everybody. This is Colin. Not too many updates for me. I just got the Wyoming draw results back, and I drew two doe pronghorn tags. We were talking about it before we started recording here. Some people might not be too happy to hear about that because they cut the number of tags, roughly in half, right, Leland?
Yeah, you son of a gun.
Yeah, so first time drawing or applying for Wyoming tags, 0 points. I ended up drawing two. Yeah, looking forward to that. It should be a good time down in Wyoming in October. And then we're just looking forward to the Oregon draw results coming out later this week. Should be supposed to be sometime around the 20th, might be a couple days before, might be a couple days after. Hopefully get some good ones there. Other than that, not much going on. I've got my bitters recipes going right now, spruce tip bitters and Douglas fir bitters as well.
I just started my spruce tip ones today. So oh, nice. I'm pretty stoked.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm using some Oregon based vodka for it. So it's, trying to keep things local.
Nice.
And I got some spruce tip syrup going too in one of the windowsills. So yeah, looking to, see how those turn out. Hopefully make some good cocktails.
Yeah, sounds like recipe for old fashions to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. Not everything needs to be a seasoning sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. I was just thinking that there's a great little distillery in Portland that makes some really nice whiskeys that... Stone Barn Distillery makes some really nice kind of small batch whiskeys that would probably go real well with a spruce tip bitters.
Ooh, that sounds
yeah.
Good.
We had this is a recipe taken from a guy that we met at Rendezvous few weeks ago, and he made some cocktails after the I think it was like the bonfire night or something. Yeah, they're pretty fantastic.
Yo, we were hanging out that night, and you guys didn't invite me to join you for your cocktail.
It wasn't my invite to give. Yeah, I might be a little late on the spruce tips, though. They have, I don't know if you'd call them bloomed, but they've opened up a little bit, so they're not like the real compact little ones.
So
we'll see.
I was looking at the same thing, and so I was looking on... the Forger Chefs on his website, he did like a little review on spruce tips, and he was still using like the fully opened ones. And so I went yesterday, and I'm in the same boat as you. They're a little later, but they're still softer than the like
yeah
the
still
full
soft,
grown one.
Still very bright green, so that's what that's what I'm banking on. But the Douglas fir ones are really nice too. Very soft, almost like feathery. And they have a little bit different smell, too. So I thought about combining them, but I kept them separate and see how those turn out, too. Same recipe, same other spices in them, just a slightly different flavor.
I'm excited to hear how that Douglas fir one came out. So I did the blue spruce and white spruce.
Okay.
But Jamie Carlson is who you mentioned earlier. So actually we're going to get Jamie on the show, hopefully here very soon. We'll be talking about wild cocktails, which I think is a fascinating topic.
There's
he opened my eyes this last Rendezvous. I was just like, holy smokes, this is great.
I mean, but we can talk about meat all day long, but where it really gets interesting is the other stuff, right? The cocktails, the syrup. Yeah.
And Corey, what do you got going on for updates? It's been a minute.
Yeah, I've been kind of MIA the past couple months. I had a pretty good trout season this in PA this year. You know, caught some nice fish, and then starting to get into bass season here. Haven't got out too much though. But the reason that is I ended up with a Brittany, so I now have a Brittany puppy. That I'm trying to train to become a bird dog. So So we'll see how that goes. First time trying to do that. And as I'm sitting here talking, or, you know, listen to you guys talk, he peed on the kitchen floor. So, you know, if I don't answer your questions, it's because I run into to get him to do something. But it's a slow process so far, but he's a good puppy, and I'm excited to hunt with him. One of my good friends got one of his litter mates, so we've been, you know, trying to train together. We went to a bird dog club, learning different techniques and stuff. So I'm really excited to get him out this fall.
Is the bird dog club? That's where a bunch of bird dogs hang around and eat kibble and talk about all their hunting days.
Exactly. Yeah. How'd you know?
But just a guess.
Yeah. So they have. So what's good about the bird dog club is they have homing pigeons.
Mm.
So you can use the pigeons for training, and you don't have to have, you know, your own coop. And then they have the electronic launchers, and they have the acreage and everything, that all the tools you need to do the training. And it's, you know, 20 minutes up the road. So
it's pretty cool.
Yeah, so I'm hoping to take advantage of that. And, you know, since my friend has a pup the same age, we can learn together, figure it out together. So hopefully this fall I can get on some birds. We have in PA, they stalk pheasants, so they stalk pretty heavily in my area. But then we also have a grouse, ruffed grouse season, although the population's declining a little bit, so the season has been shortened the past few years. I think it might be only a week or two long now, but just, you know, just getting out there with the dog and getting in the woods, I'm really looking forward to. And then just bought my hunting license for PA, what was it, Monday? And being a PA resident, you can hunt from September to February for $100-$150 bucks. I got 5 doe tags, a buck tag, pheasant tag, archery tag.
Rubbing love tag. Those whitetail populations, yeah. Don't you?
Migratory bird tag, you know, all that fun stuff for $125 bucks. So, hoping to fill the freezer.
Yeah, I hope so. Get ready for a flintlock again.
Yeah. Hopefully you can make it out again.
Hopefully it's not like a frozen tundra.
Oh, it will be.
Great. No, I've been talking it up, so expect some visitors.
Good. I got to get the gun fixed and so that we have that extra gun.
Nice. Cool. Well, no, glad to have you back. Glad you're able to break away from the dog. If you need to pause to go take a potty break, we totally understand. So
I have to take elk breaks with mine because there was just an elk in my neighbor's yard and my dog was barking up a storm at it. So yeah, I understand.
That's awesome. Well, let me briefly introduce Leland and Chris. So Leland Brown, he's the Oregon Zoo's non-lead hunting education coordinator and a lifelong outdoorsman. And Chris Parrish is the president and CEO of the Peregrine Fund. So welcome, guys.
And a lifelong outdoorsman.
And a lifelong outdoorsman. Welcome both to the Wild Fishing Game podcast. So if you guys want to tell us a little bit about yourself, I guess you guys can decide who wants to go first.
Sure, I'll start off since I got introduced first. You know, that tells you a little something about who's really the important one around here, because they always leave the best for last, right? so, yeah, I work for the Oregon Zoo. I we'll start from the beginning. I grew up in New Hampshire, so not far away from Corey there, up in the North Woods. Got a degree in environmental biology. Got a job doing invasive species removal in the Channel Islands off the coast of Southern California. San Clemente. So spent three years out there doing some protection work around some endangered bird species. Got a job up in Central California around Salinas, Hollister, down there on National Park, doing feral pig removal stuff. Got introduced to non-lead ammo through all of that. Started using it. Stuff worked real well. Got a job in Hawaii. Started shooting pigs and goats and everything out there. Started talking all the folks I worked for and using non-lead there for the stuff we were doing, in part because we were giving some of that meat away to locals so that they could make use of it, need it. And then this job came up in Oregon, and I said, you know what? I want to be one of the people leading that so that it doesn't get done the wrong way, so we don't end up with all the issues and conflict and everything else that happened in other places. So moved to Oregon in 2015. Been here ever since. Been running the Oregon program and worked with Chris and several other colleagues to start the non-lead partnership in 2018, and we've been running that ever since, trying to build up interest and momentum there. So that was about as short as I can make it for that one.
So now that we know a little bit about you guys, I guess let's talk a little bit on the wild game side. So where do you guys lie as far as a favorite wild game?
Oh, they're all so good. How do you choose, man? You know, I tend to be partial these days towards whatever's on top of the freezer and whatever I can experiment with, which is, you know, the easy kind of soft way out, right? It's like, oh yeah, but really it's part of that's the fun, right? Is playing around with it and trying to get whatever you've got available to really taste the way you want. I mean, it's all good. Growing up in New Hampshire, you know, my favorite introduction to game meat was moose. And there's still a soft spot in my heart for that just because it was some of the first game meat I ever ate. These days, elk and blacktail are kind of the staples for me. So that's what I go with most of the time. Not a huge bird hunter, but I'll tell you what, the turkeys I shot last year, I didn't get out very much this year. I didn't get one, but I could make some real damn good turkey. That's tough. Yeah, it's too hard to pick one. I just can't do it. It's like I try to, and then I go, oh, but what about this one? That was so good when I made that. Or, you know, this thing was real tasty. I've really come around these days to using a lot more kind of Indian spices with some of the game meat. I've really been digging that a lot.
Like curries, really, like tikka masala type stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think those bold flavors bode really, really well with the bold flavors of some of the game meats too.
Yeah, they complement each other well. And I found a recipe a while back on, it must have been Meat Eater or something. I think Daniel Pruitt had a shank recipe that was like a osobuco, Indian style osobuco. And that,
oh, nice.
Really, if I'm looking for something that's like gonna get people fired up about trying game meat for the first time, that's usually what I go towards, because once it's done, it's just that slow cooked strong flavors, you just can't beat it. And then you get a little bit of the marrow mixed in there, and it's fantastic.
And I think too, like when you introduce folks to that, like kind of that big meal, it's a bold flavor from the beginning. So if they're not used to kind of the flavors of wild game, they're not like surprised, because you're already like, hey, try this with all these great spices in it. And also this delicious meat. And they're like, oh, whoa. Yeah, this is great.
it gets them away from like the, oh, this steak tastes kind of funny, right? Like if you just do like a straight steak with game meat and doesn't taste like, you know, corn-fed beef, like, oh, this is odd. But if that's already off from kind of the standard flavor, then they don't have that reaction.
Yep. I think we lost Chris. He may have got disconnected here.
Yeah, his internet wasn't super great there for a second.
No. We can give him just a minute. If he doesn't make it back on, then we can just keep plugging along, and we'll have to make some edits initially.
Yeah, we can just say that he's got terrible internet, and that's what he gets living up there.
I found that the Indian spices work really well for a lot of the waterfowl out here, especially where I am out on the coast. Get a lot of that, like we've talked about it. I talked about it 1,000 times on the show here. Kind of like
your marshy goose,
marshy swampy geese and ducks, and it's like people are like, oh no, you're just like, no, that's just how they taste, and you got to get used to them. I brought them out to Justin and some other folks, and they were like, oh yeah, there's something wrong with your ducks, man. but those, like, I made an awesome tikka masala with I think it was a couple pintail breasts, and then I've recently discovered that mustard cuts through a lot of that flavor, like the real swampy brackish flavor. So I'm planning on doing
that. Wait, so hold on. Like mustard, ground mustard, like mustard, the sauce, the accompaniment, what?
Yeah. Do you remember at Rendezvous the one night where I don't know if you were there. I think you may have been cooking for the first night, the dinner, but we put some goose wings in the cast iron and just basically squirted French's yellow mustard all over them and fried them up, and they turned out awesome. Yeah, it, like, something happens, some chemical reaction happens, and it cuts out all that stuff. So I have a whole goose in my freezer right now, and I want to do like a slow cooked kind of almost like mustard based barbecue sauce and break it down like that.
Yeah, I was going to say that, like, mustard barbecue probably is an easy, you know, marinate in some of that and then slow cook it. Probably be awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the same experience with some of the geese from just south of Portland here where I had them and tried to cook them kind of like, oh, this will be good. You know, they've been eaten on the fields. They're probably pretty good. It had pretty strong livery, kind of marshy flavor, and switched it up to like a stronger marinade, and they're fantastic that way.
Yeah.
Strong sugar soy marinade with them was good.
Yeah, no salt, because they're already salty enough. It's like saltwater plants. Yeah. Definitely don't need more salt.
This is interesting. I wonder if you could get behind like some of those like Carolina based, like real heavy vinegar barbecue sauces too.
Probably.
If that would, it's where you have a research project, I think, Colin. I'm going to have to come out and eat the goose.
Yeah.
experiment with it for sure.
See what happens. I think I got a couple whole ducks, a couple whole geese in my freezer. So yeah, we'll see.
We have to go like wild food test kitchen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that'd be fun. Let me know when you're coming out to do that.
Yeah, man.
I got some tungsten laying around. I can contribute to the cause.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet. Well, let's I don't think Chris is going to make it back, unfortunately. So
he was trying. It looks like he just got back onto the Google Doc, but I don't know what that means for getting back into this.
Yeah,
this form, but
well, I guess what do you got working next recipe wise, Leland? What are you thinking?
I don't know. I just came back. My wife and I were in Europe for my brother-in-law got married, so I just got back last Friday from 2 weeks over there. So I'm like so behind with stuff that we don't even have anything in the fridge yet. It's like we've been doing like one day at a time trying to get stuff figured out. So I got to sit down one of the next couple of days and actually take a look at what we got in the freezer and start making some plans.
Nice. Yeah.
Still got some elk left that I got to get through. Still got some turkey legs. I got to figure out what I plan on doing with those. So that's kind of next on the list of looking around and seeing what I come up with.
I did like a cassoulet with the turkey legs. Turkey legs and thighs and wings, and man, it came out really, really good.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'll have to take a look at that.
Bacon and beans and oof.
Mm-hmm.
It's good. So all right, well, yeah, I'm not sure Chris is gonna make it. Bummer. But all right, well, I guess let's get into it then. So how did the North American non-lead partnership come around?
Yeah, well, I mean, I hit on that a little bit when we were talking about my origin story. So let's 2010 or so, I got hired to do that feral pig project down in Central California. And as part of that, they basically said, hey, if you want to shoot pigs, you got to do outreach, because around that time, California had recently passed the laws requiring non-lead ammo in a portion of the state. And I really didn't want to do outreach, but I also really wanted to shoot pigs, so I started doing outreach. And that got me down this path, right? I started doing this removal project, started shooting pigs with non-lead, getting a lot of experience using it, doing a lot of testing, and then doing a bunch of outreach around this and talking with folks and figuring out what kind of information they were looking for. And in doing all of that, I also got to know some of these other folks like Chris and a few of our other partners. And then I left because I didn't want to do just outreach. I wanted to be shooting stuff. And the Feral Pig Project came to an end. So I moved to Hawaii and was there for just under 3 years. But then when I moved back to Oregon, one of the first things I did was reach out to all these guys that I'd worked with before and say, hey, what's going on? Like, are y'all working together still? You know, you talking? What's the plan? What are we doing? And pretty quickly, we all started talking about the need to kind of do a bigger kind of continent-wide effort, because, you know, these one-offs, Chris working in Arizona and with Utah to do stuff there, me working in Oregon, some of these guys trying to deal with all the blowback around the laws that got passed in California and share good information with people down there so that they could be successful. We're all running into the same problems, and there's like, how do we build consistency out? And that's where the idea of the partnership came from, is how do we create an organization where as these conversations happen, we can help people through this process in what we feel is the most effective way, which is working in cooperation with our fellow hunters, and anglers here or there, but you know, we mostly focus on hunting these days, in having this conversation and working with the state agencies, working with the hunting organizations, working with the hunters themselves. And so that started 2015 and took a couple of years of work and effort and talking and planning. In 2018, we launched the partnership with a number of partners that we kind of had already built up over the years, including Arizona, Game and Fish, Utah Wildlife Division, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And now we're looking at across the country, across the continent, you know, Canada and U.S., we've got something like 44 partners, I think, at this point, all hunting kind of based organizations, few landowners, mostly hunting conservation groups, things like that, and the co-founders being, you know, Oregon Zoo, Institute for Wildlife Studies, which is the outfit I used to work for down in California, that's still running a lot of the outreach down there, and the Peregrine Fund. Kind of kicked it all off and been going ever since.
Man, yeah, I'm looking at your guys' partners list, and it's quite a good group of folks. A lot of people doing a lot of good work across the country, too.
Yeah, and, you know, the big thing for us is, you know, we're all about keeping hunting strong, making sure that hunting continues to be the leading one of the leading voices in conservation. We really feel strongly that the choice in ammunition is a really strong way to continue that, to make sure that when we say one shot, one kill, we're guaranteeing that as much as possible, because the remnants of our bullet are going to have zero impact on anything else. Mm-hmm. Good stewardship, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good point you brought up, is like that one shot, focus on the one shot, one kill, but also too with the ammo selection, and I think that being, both of those being pretty key features in my mind, is sort of like talking points, I guess, and maybe you guys experience different.
No, man, I think that's true. I mean, like, if you think about it, every single one of us, when we're choosing ammo and choosing to squeeze the trigger, we're looking to be as efficient and as effective mm-hmm. as possible on that animal, whether it's a grouse flying through the trees or an elk, you know, or, you know, an antelope out there in the sagebrush. We're expecting the ammunition to work and put that mm-hmm. animal on the ground. None of us wants to wound stuff. No one wants to, you know, chase something. No one wants to be responsible for or feel that kind of heartache of having something get away from us. At the same time, there's some other stuff happening that we didn't know about for a long time, right? If we talk about weight retention on our ammunition and performance, bullets are losing 20 to 40% of the weight. It doesn't just disappear into thin air, right? It ends up somewhere. And it ends up along the path of that bullet from point of impact till point of exit. And there's a lot of good research now that really documents this well. And a lot of people say, well, you know, my one shot couldn't possibly do that much. I recovered the bullet. It's like, yeah, you recovered the bullet, but it's 70% of what it was when it started. Mm-hmm. That 30% is now distributed through those lungs, maybe the heart, whatever those organs are that we're going to leave in the field, which is a fantastic food source for all this other stuff. And it really is a pretty good food source for those other critters, especially that time of year, right? We're moving into winter. We're getting into the time where it's going to be tough sailing for a lot of wildlife, and they're looking for those easy sources of food. And if they're picking up that gut pile, and I get irritated about this, so I'm just going to say it up front, right? People say, oh, I don't shoot it in the guts. Like, yeah, come on, man. You know what we're talking about. When you gut an animal, we're not saying just the guts, right? You're talking about all the lungs and everything. So yep. Don't give me that. Like, you know what I'm talking about. You're just being a bit of a twerp about it, to put it lightly. trying not to curse. I'm trying to, like, you know, I have a hard time. I grew up working in kitchens, like,
yeah,
cursing is what you do.
Yep. Okay, we'll dub something over them that's more offensive. So,
yeah. Perfect. Yeah, really make sure my boss listens. we can make sure I do real well at the zoo. Sorry, I lost track by complaining about people talking about gut piles. But yeah, I mean, you know, we're leaving these food sources out there, and it's, you know, it's creating impacts that we didn't plan on. And for mm-hmm. me, that's the biggest thing, right? Well, you know, I don't care if I, you know, kill a coyote. Great, me either, if I meant to. You know, yeah. I do things on purpose. I use my tools effectively, right?
Shooting a coyote intentionally and, like, it kind of dealing with the whole lead exposure, lead poisoning thing is, like, very too drastic comparisons, for sure.
Right. Right. It's intentional and managed. Right? And that's the big thing. If we're going to talk about hunting as a well-managed conservation activity, which it is, right? If you mm-hmm. talk about the act of hunting, you know, we're talking about management. There should be some ability to look at that and say, this is how it's working. This is the impact that we're having. And we can address this by changing the management rules. These things that we're doing on accident don't fall under that. And so we've got to be careful of that. We've got to be aware of that. And we've got to address it so we can continue to take advantage of these wild resources. Because if we don't, you know, it's an easy point of attack on that use, saying, well, you guys aren't managing this part of it. So why do we trust you to manage the rest of it?
You're right. It goes back to that stewardship piece and even, you know, it's a We are the keepers. What is it? We're the keepers of our resources for the next generation. And it's like, yeah, if our careless mistakes lead to a decline, then really, who's going to turn around and be like, oh yeah, those guys back then, they were not good stewards. I mean, we do that now with past generations when you talk about overhunting and overfishing. Like, so you can't point the finger. What is it? You can't point a finger when there's four pointing back at you, or three, whatever it is.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah.
I mean, three.
My thumb doesn't go that way, but I get it just right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's for me, that's the big, how do we protect both the tradition of hunting, the use of these resources, and continue to conserve our wildlife and be good stewards at the same time? For me, the use of non-lead is one of those. It's one of those ways we do that.
How do you see that continuity growing, and how do you see more folks getting involved?
I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of that happen, right? I mean, you just look at the number of partners that we've got now over the last 4 years, and you can see that it's shifting, right? We went from starting with four or five partners to now 40-something. That's pretty solid engagement. The other side of it is we're seeing a lot of different states and organizations looking for ways to engage. We're getting requests from people saying, how do we do this? How do we do it in a way that just makes sense both for managing wildlife and being good stewards, but also for hunters? Because that's the biggest thing. One of the biggest things for me is I do not want this to turn into something that disrupts our ability to hunt. I want it to be something that continues to build and support our ability to hunt. And we're seeing that happen, right? And you get a lot of folks, even just invites to these podcasts, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
5-6 years ago, getting an invite on a podcast like this wasn't really happening, right? People weren't having the conversation. People may have been aware of it, but there was no real way to have that conversation. There wasn't anyone to talk to for a lot of time.
And I was thinking about, I remember, so I was back in California in 2010 to 2015, kind of like during that time period of like after the law was passed and like hunters were kind of trying to figure out how to navigate it and sort of what to do. And it was just like, I remember thinking about it and us even going hunting up in those areas where the lead free restrictions were. And I just like, I couldn't wrap my mind around it. And like, you know, forgive me, but I grew up in like southeastern Oklahoma, and it's just like you hunted with what you had. You went to the store and bought and did it, and like never thought anything else. And I was just like, lead free. And I was just like, I don't like my mind.
The first question is, what the hell is that? Right? Like, I've never even heard of it. And that was my response, right? When I got hired to do that feral pig project, I had heard about it because the company I was working for had already started doing some outreach. So I'd kind of like, oh yeah, they're just doing something about this non-lead stuff. But I didn't know what any of it actually was. Like, I didn't have any idea who the manufacturers were. I didn't know what the bullets were. I didn't know where I could get them. I didn't know any of that stuff. So I started. I didn't know how they worked. I started, I said, look, man, I'll consider it, but I need to see the evidence. I need to see the papers, the science that documents that this is an actual issue, because I'm not going to get involved in something that I don't think is real. And so I started reading it, and I was like, ah, crap, how did I not know this? You know, I was a professional wildlife biologist whose job was to shoot and kill animals. You know, that's a standard slightly above, you know, your public hunter who just is buying a tag and going out and obeying the laws, right? I should have been at a higher standard. And I didn't know it. So the expectation that your general hunter buying a tag would know it, just, it's not possible. It's a flawed ideology, which, you know, and we got to talk about California a little bit, right? Like, you got to remember that CDFW didn't pass that law. You know, everyone's like, oh, it's the Condor folks. Condor folks didn't pass that law. What happened is people did some research, Chris being one of them, did some research, published it, and then some kind of other groups that I won't name went to the legislature and said, you guys have to do something. Here's this research. Well, the researchers were saying, wait, don't do that, and got a law passed that forced CDFW to do something. And then happened again in 2013 for the statewide stuff. Was that the right thing to do? I personally don't really think so. I think we could have had a lot of success by talking with our fellow hunters and saying, hey, man, we're finding some stuff out. Let's talk about how we solve this problem.
I think maybe it created some unforeseen issues, or maybe foreseen issues, however you want to think about it, from whoever's perspective is presenting it, and maybe kind of slowed down that movement. Because I think you're right. And like from a hunter's perspective, like those conversations, especially with biologists and law enforcement folks, like those matter.
Yeah. Yeah, and
The other side of the aisle, it's like, if you're telling me I have to do this and you're not giving me an option to opt in, like it automatically makes me kind of question everything.
Yeah, well, I told you I grew up in New Hampshire, right? You know, the state motto in New Hampshire, live free or die. So, you know, that gives you a little idea about where I generally come from with the idea of doing a whole bunch of regulation before even talking about it. So it's like, that's just not the way to go about it. And yeah, I mean, I listened to your guys' previous episode with John McAdams, and he mentioned that, right? Saying, you know, hey, I don't really have an issue with non-lead bullets. They work pretty well. I've used them quite a bit. I think they're effective. But you tell me what to do, that I have to do something, and I immediately get my hackles up. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, no kidding. Like, who doesn't, right? If you're hanging out, having, you know, doing what you believe is right, and someone tells you, oh, you can't do that anymore, and doesn't give you any real reason why that you understand, it's not coming from someone you trust, why would you be like, oh, yeah, okay, that sounds great? It just doesn't work that way. No one works that way. I sure as hell don't work that way. So,
So through the work that you guys have been doing with the non-lead partnership, and then, of course, all your partners, as we look at like this kind of trickle down, do you think the road's kind of getting smoothed out a little bit?
I think it is. I mean, it's not easy. Don't get me wrong. Like, things aren't easy still. I mean, you still run across a lot of people. All you got to do is go on any forum and read a forum discussion around non-lead ammo, and you can see all these different opinions. But I think in person, especially, like when we go and we talk to these folks, like we'll do these workshops, we'll come in, we'll present what we know from the science, what best available science is telling us, how we understand how these exposures are happening, why we, you know, the evidence is pointing towards ammunition as the source, what the potential impacts of that are, what the research is telling us there, and then what the options are that allow us to be effective hunters, but also, you know, avoid those issues. Pretty consistently, we get, you know, real positive response, and often from folks who coming in were pretty negative about it, and were like, this is an anti-hunting bunch of bull. All you got to do is talk to Chris and me for 10 minutes, and you know we're not anti-hunting, right? I mean, like, I'm all about going out there. I just want to make sure that we're doing it in a way that protects it long term.
Sure. you had mentioned some of the research. What's kind of some of the research that you guys see supporting?
Yeah, I mean, the basic is, right, I mean, it's documentation of weight loss from ammunition and where that weight loss ends up. You know, you're seeing on average, in both, you know, controlled testing and when you're looking at, you know, field testing of ammunition, when you shoot an animal, you can x-ray it, and lead shows up really well in x-rays, right? Because it's a heavy metal and it reflects all those x-rays right back. It's a bright white spot. So you x-ray stuff and you count and you see how many fragments are there. And on average, you're looking at over 100 fragments per bullet from a lead core bullet. And that doesn't really seem to matter too much. I mean, it varies depending on bullet construction, some more, some less. But even bonded bullets, consistently, you're seeing some of that weight loss happening. And, you know, you hit bone, that's going to increase. You have a close shot, that's going to increase. It's further away, and you don't hit bone, it's going to decrease. So you see that variation happening. On the other side of that is, where does that end up, right? You do these testing and you x-ray whole animal, and then you x-ray, you know, the gut pile and the lungs and all that, and you see, hey, a lot of these fragments are ending up in the things that we leave in the field. So it's not just lost soft animals
tissue,
right?
Yeah,
it's the animals, when we're successful in leaving that source behind, we're still leaving that for other scavengers to feed on.
And then the next step, of course, is, okay, well, is that actually having an impact on those animals? So they do blood testing, and they do blood testing across the year. And they say, okay, well, in the spring and summer, we see reduced levels of lead exposure, but all of a sudden, as these carcasses or the remains of animals are in the field, we see lead exposure rates going up. And they're going through the roof, and they match pretty closely with the number of carcasses on the ground. So there's been multiple studies looking at that saying, hey, spring and summer, not much exposure. Fall, winter, when those carcasses are available, ton of exposure at really high levels of exposure. And a lot of this is done in eagles and ravens. They tend to be kind of the focal species a lot of times. California condor is another one. Because they were so closely watched as an endangered species, mm-hmm. every bird was being tested. They got a lot of kind of baseline information there saying, hey, this is a potential source of exposure, and then expanded that across all these other species. It's a great study out of Quebec looking at moose harvest, and basically they looked at ravens' blood levels in this population as they captured birds, and saw at the start of moose season, levels of exposure are pretty low, but as they climbed, or as the number of carcasses climbed through the season, right? You get a long go through the season, you get more and more animals on the ground. You saw a corresponding increase in blood lead levels in those ravens, in that raven population as they captured birds. Then they also did the isotope studies. And the isotope studies showed that the type of lead matched the type of lead used in bullets, and did not match the type of lead used in it that was remnant from like leaded gasoline and things like that, which would be in mm-hmm. lichen and soil. So as lead levels climbed, the isotope in the blood changed to match. When higher levels of exposure in the blood changed to match the type of lead that's recycled lead used in bullets. It's not to say there are other sources of lead out there, right? There's studies out of like Coeur d'Alene where they've got some of the mining waste, and they've got pretty strong evidence that those point sources are sources of lead exposure. It's just these are some of the ones that are distributed widely across the landscape. And it's a food source that you see them feeding on. People will bring up all sorts of, oh, well, it could be this, it could be that. Like, okay, that's cool, but we don't see birds feeding on that. And if that was happening, if it was one of these other sources, you would see it happening consistently across the year, right? If it was soil, there wouldn't be a spike when carcasses availability increased, because the soil is going to be the same all year.
Standard, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right? Availability is the same across the year. What's changing is this availability of this new food source. You see the same thing happening with, like ground squirrel shooting. And that's slightly different because now you're talking about nestlings and golden eagles and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they see when golden eagles are nesting closer to areas where they have ground squirrel shooting, you have higher levels of lead exposure in the nestlings because they've got an easy source of food that they can bring back to them real quick. So that's the baseline for a lot of the kind of research. It's linking in, exposure in these populations across the year. And we're talking, we're not talking about small levels of exposure. We're talking about anywhere from 25 to, in some studies, 90% of the population of eagles having high levels of lead during that time of year.
Wow.
So we're not talking about just like, oh, it's just a couple. Mortalities are a whole different thing. Like, it gets confusing because you test these birds in, you release them, and sometimes you just don't know what happens to them. So we know that, okay, these exposure rates are happening at these different levels in this percentage of these populations. What's the long-term outcome of that? Well, we know that at certain cases, it's mortality. But lead doesn't just kill things. It also can change behavior, impact kind of long-term survival, it can impact reproduction. So there's been some recent research that's come out in the last year or so that says that we're actually reducing growth rates of like bald eagles. That was one of the big ones. You're seeing a reduction in growth rate in bald eagles and in golden eagles as well, continent-wide. Meaning that, hey, bald eagles are off the endangered species list, but they're still not to historic levels, right? I mean, they're not endangered anymore. That doesn't mean they're back to where they were in, the early 1800s or whatever. They're still down.
Just because they're not on the endangered list doesn't mean we shouldn't protect them and keep an eye out for them.
Right.
And
I'm a little concerned in part because there actually are laws protecting bald and golden eagles outside of the Endangered Species Act. And I'm worried that at some point, and, you know, I worry sometimes about talking about this, but it's important for us as hunters to realize is some group's going to use that to sue. There's just a way, you know, it's the way some of the model of some of the environmental groups is to litigate, to create the change that they're looking for. And if they're able to make a legitimate claim that we're having these negative impacts through our hunting ammunition, that's a problem for us as hunters. And so I think we should...
That leads to like a larger like California scenario all over again. Right. Where instead of where the hunters as conservationists are leading the charge, it's, well, now there's going to be more of those negative impacts across the board.
Right.
Nobody's going to have a choice.
And it doesn't give you that... if I think about this, what I'm thinking about a lot of the time is how we're presenting hunting to the non-hunting public. Mm-hmm. I just saw something today. I was in a meeting about an anti-poaching deal happening in Oregon. And they were presenting on some of the support numbers for hunting. And you got like 85% support for hunting in Oregon, which is pretty damn good for a state a lot of people look at and go, oh, there's a bunch of liberal tree huggers over there. the 85% solid, right? But it's easy to have that eroded away. And how do we build that number rather than having it be eroded? How do we build it so we got 95% or even 90%? Because there's certain people who just will never be supportive of hunting. The idea of killing an animal just isn't on their radar. And that's fine. That's a legitimate personal choice. But we want those who do eat meat, who do consider eating, you know, an animal okay, to also support hunting. And one of the ways we can do that is to continue to be leaders and make sure that we're not being forced to do things, but we're creating choices that when people look at hunting, they say, oh, look at all those good things they did. Look at the things they did to recover elk. Look at the things they did to recover wild turkey. Look at the things they're doing to protect eagles and ravens and all these other non-target species that they will never hunt, right? Because a lot of the arguments we'll hear about hunting and conservation is, oh, well, you just did that because you wanted more of them to hunt. It's like, yeah, I did. I wanted to hunt wild turkeys. That's why we worked so hard on recovering them. That doesn't mean it's not a good thing. But this effort removes that argument. It says we're not ever going to be hunting bald eagles. Like, it's not going to happen. But we can still do something and have that be kind of feather in the cap, you know, long term. Like, when we say hunting is conservation, right? It's not because we just buy tags. It's because we do stuff, right? Yep. We have to do things. And this is one of those tools that we can use, one of those things that we can do.
Nice.
I feel like
Colin,
I've been rambling a lot. So you can tell me to shut up anytime.
Colin, you got any thoughts?
No, I'm taking it all in. Those are all like really good points. I can tell you've practiced that speech a lot.
I mean,
practiced the points a lot.
It's the thing is, it's not even like you say practice, and it's like, yeah, I guess. But it's not like I sat in the mirror, right? I had these conversations with people over and over, and people will fight me on one thing or another, and it's like, okay, you're right about that. Let me rethink that then.
What's the best argument you've heard against lead-free?
Access.
Like
accessibility is lower. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was where I was going to go.
It's harder to find.
Price of ammunition is just climbing, and it's hard to find anything. So,
so
when you add that non-lead factor to it, it's just even
Although,
harder.
Sometimes it's easier to find non-lead these days than it is to find some of the lead stuff, right?
Find steel shot.
So for me, like, price is one thing, and I think people, you know, if you compare like your budget ammunition lines, you pay a little bit more for non-lead generally because it's a premium. It's usually in the premium line of ammunition. At the same time, you're usually paying the same price you'd pay for premium ammunition. So if you're willing to pay for like Federal Vital Shock or something, you'd be paying the same price whether you're buying lead or non-lead at this point for a box of factory ammo. The question is, when you go into your local shop, is it sitting there on the shelf?
Right.
And that's a real challenge, because depending on the shop, it may or may not. And then you run into problems like California or New York, where they pass laws about ordering ammunition online, and it becomes even harder, right? If you can't order online, then access becomes even more difficult because you're reliant on whatever they've got on the shelf.
Gotcha.
So how do we change that? I don't know, it's a bit of a catch-22, right? Because, you know, manufacturers will always tell us, hey, we'll make what people are buying, and talk to people and they say, yeah, I'd love to try it, but I can't find it, you know, at the local shop, so I'm not buying it. I just buy what they've got. And it's like, well, which one comes first?
Right.
I don't know. That's one of some of the stuff we're working on through the partnership, is trying to support folks through that, make sure manufacturers are supportive, aren't actually losing business, making sure retailers have folks who are going to come in and buy ammunition, all of those different things. It's not an easy thing. There's no denying that.
I have a little bit of experience with non-lead, with the veteran pheasant hunt that I helped put on. Heavy Shot donates their heavy bismuth. Mm-hmm. And I know those are expensive boxes of ammunition, but they, from my experience, they hit hard and they put the bird down pretty quick. So it just, but buying a case of those can get expensive quick.
Yeah, for sure. And it becomes one of those kind of like, at some point it becomes a little bit of a value decision, right? It's like, where does this fall within my choices? And you know, I'd personally like to see people choose a non-lead because all the reasons I've already stated, and we'll probably state again, you know, in 5 minutes. But at the same time, I can't force people, you know, people will say, oh, well, we can pass a law and we'll force people to do it. It's like, bullshit. You can't force people to do anything. You can give them the information and the tools and the know-how to make a choice. Even in California, they're still making a choice, right? Because you can still go buy lead ammo.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't believe the law is worthwhile, they can still go buy and use non-lead ammo for hunting. They might get fined if they're caught, but they're still making a choice there.
Mm-hmm. I think about that, the concept of like voting with your dollar, like United States. It's we're a capitalist country, and you know, you support the businesses you support, whether you realize it or not, with your money. And so, if you go and you're purchasing non-lead ammo, then you are in fact supporting that form of conservation and the movement of non-lead. If you go out and, you know, in a conversation, you tell me, no, like non-lead's great. It's, you know, I definitely believe in it. I'm with the values that movement supports. And then you go out and do different, then you're not supporting it, not in the way that you should be.
No, but I mean, I also want to be really clear. Like there's ways to help that don't mm-hmm. involve using non-lead, right? You folks in Arizona for the last over a decade at this point, and I wish Chris could be here because, you know, he could tell you all about this, but, you know, they've got voluntary programs on the Kaibab Plateau deer hunts where they've got, you know, over 80% participation for over a decade. And that's either using non-lead or packing out the entire animal, including all the organs. And people are packing these organs into trash bags and carrying them out with them. You want to talk about dedication to conservation?
Yeah.
Someone packing their gut pile into a trash bag and hauling it out? I'm not doing that. It's way easier for me to use non-lead bullet. And they're effective and they work well. I'll just do that, man. But these guys, you know, these guys and gals are doing that. And if you can't find non-lead ammo, that is an option. That's something that you can do. It's way harder, in my opinion, but it's definitely something that you can do. The only problem for me with that is, you know, if you happen to have one of those bad days where you end up wounding an animal, now you still have some issues there. Or, you know, the other side of that is you're not leaving that resource now for all the other critters mm-hmm. out there.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. That, yeah, wow.
That jogs my memory. I have heard of people packing out the organs before, and I forget where I heard it. It must have been a couple of years ago.
I'm trying to think. There's
a lot harder to do with elk, though, is the problem, right? Oh, like, you know, mule deer, you can pull it off. You try to haul out an elk gut pile or a moose gut pile or a bison gut pile.
100 like, pounds of not solid stuff just floating around in a trash bag.
That thing's going to be all over the place. Yeah.
Try carrying a trash bag full of water and see how it works out for you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I was just thinking about, there's a military base in Florida that's got a big bombing and air Eglin. Reserve range and
Eglin.
Is it Eglin? I forget do you remember what the name of the specific area is?
Oh, the one that we were looking at?
Yeah.
No, I forget that one. Eglin's down by south of Miami.
Yeah. I can't think of the name of the exact place, but that's what it if you hunted deer out there, you had to take the whole deer out, and they had a specific processing station, and you had to discard the guts while you were there, and it was very regulated, and you couldn't leave them in the field, and I'm wondering if that definitely was in line with that regulation, or if there was something else.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Chris has been doing some work with different DOD folks. Like, they've been working out on White Sands, doing some of this documentation of scavenger use of these kind of remains. And they're really popular with scavengers again, right? Like golden eagles, all these things. Like, you're getting a lot of animals coming in and feeding on one gut pile. We did the same thing on Zumwalt Prairie Preserve over in Northeast Oregon when we were out there. We shot an elk, threw gut, camera up on the gut pile. I mean, I think within 2 hours, we had several ravens and several immature golden eagles on it feeding. And this one was shot with a non-lead bullet, but it was really a solid demonstration of the kind of potential impact you can have, because you're not talking about one animal. You're talking about a lot of different animals coming in and feeding on this. There was a bear sitting on it for 3 days chasing coyotes off it. It's pretty entertaining to watch. but it's, we don't see a lot of impact on bears. We don't see a lot of impact on coyotes. Part of it's are people even looking? We didn't know about a lot of the avian or, the bird stuff until we started looking at it. People have done a little bit looking at bears and other things, but digestive systems are different. Risk is lower because of the digestive system. So there's a lot of different things going into that.
Justin, it was Avon Park.
Avon Park, yeah, that's it. I'm curious too. Like, I've seen mentioned in places, about fishing as well, and the use of lead and fishing and all that. Have you guys seen the results of that?
Yeah, and even that, right, seems to come back to bird species is what what seems to happen mostly. So if you look up in the Northeast, right, you look at Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, I think even Massachusetts, I'm not sure what other states in there, but they were seeing close to 60%, I think it was, of common loon mortalities being from lead exposure from fishing weights. And so they actually, that becomes, hey, you've got that much of mortality being caused by an anthropogenic source like fishing weights, the agencies have to do something about that. It's just, they don't have any way to avoid but passing regulation there. So I think you're actually required to use fishing weights under an ounce, have to be non-lead up in those areas. That's not something that, as a partnership, that's not our role, right? We don't have that regulatory authority or responsibility. We're here to provide best available information about what the science tells us, try to look at what the tools are that we can use, work with those agencies or, the hunters and hunting organizations to come up with we think a lot more about best practices rather than regulation, kind of from our side, is what's the best way that we continue to hunt, be successful, and what are the tools that we have available to make sure we are avoiding these, conflicting impacts with what we want to accomplish.
Sure. No, I think that's, that's perfect.
You see it other places too. I think Trumpeter swans, you see some of the fishing weight stuff. Again, for me, a lot of it is, how do we talk to people about ways that we can address this?
Yeah.
Make it work.
Yeah. So I think, unfortunately, we're starting to wind down on time. Definitely a good conversation, though. But what's a good way for people to get in touch with you guys if they want to get involved?
Yeah. I mean, nonleadpartnership.org. We've got a website where you can look at all of our partners. You can read kind of the resolution that all our partners are required to sign. Read a little bit about us. Chris and I's contact info are on there. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, Nonlead Partnership for both, since those are things that are all linked. I don't think we've got a Twitter account. I can barely keep up with the other social media. On Twitter. Sorry. I know some people like that, but it just, I don't do it. So yeah, those are the easiest ways. I mean, you can get my phone number off the website. So you got a question, you're worried about something, you can call or shoot an email. It's no problem. That's what we're here for, is to help with that.
Sweet. Well, this is kind of like our, as we wrap up here, we leave a little bit of room for everybody to give a last thought. And being you're the guest here, Leland Day, do you have a last thought for us?
I mean, we didn't even get into ballistics and terminal performance and all these other things that I usually love talking about, right? I mean, that's usually the stuff that I really get into.
I guess we'll have to have you back on.
Well, yeah, we could do that for sure. I know you guys talked about it a little bit the last last podcast, but that stuff's really interesting to me. I spent a lot of time, you know, shooting and working on that stuff. But, you know, I just encourage folks to, you know, if you haven't tried non-lead ammunition, if you're worried about it, you know, glad you listened to this podcast. Hopefully we gave you a little bit of information. Go check out, you know, our website. We've got a bunch of other podcasts and videos and other stuff that we've done. And don't be scared of it, right? I mean, you know, a lot of people are afraid that this is a slippery slope or something like that. And I think it's really the opposite, right? It's a step up to support hunting long-term. And if you're into this for the food and you have any concerns about lead, which, you know, we didn't touch into either, right? I mean, that's a personal choice. Whole nother can of worms, right? You're just definitely going to have us back, I guess. We'll get Chris on a stable internet connection. But the thing here is, you know, there's options out there, right? If you're a new hunter, if you've been a hunter for a while, there's options that allow you to continue hunting, and you can completely sidestep any of these concerns if you have them. Don't be afraid to try some of these tools and see if they'll work for you. Because in my experience, they're great, great bullets, work really well. Same as anything else, make sure they shoot well, make sure you can hit your target, and then put them to work, get animals on the ground, and start cooking.
Yeah. All right, Colin, you got any other thoughts?
Yeah, just that since I started hunting, I kind of started hunting later in my life than a lot of other people. Well, I guess not so much now, but probably when I was around like 24, so like 7 years ago. But I immediately sought out lead-free ammo for the rifle that I had at the time. And, I mean, since then I've only bought lead-free ammo for, whether it's for waterfowl, upland fowl, big game. And yeah, I've shot an elk, shot a deer with entirely lead-free, shot plenty of ducks, geese, pheasants with it. So it's not like this, like you were saying, it's not like an ammunition that's lower quality and can't get the job done. It absolutely gets the job done. And there are a lot of companies out there right now that are definitely kind of advertising for that too. Well, my rifle ammo is, I mean, not to like plug them, but is Federal, and it works just as good as any other ammo that they have. So yeah, I think it's a good cause to get behind. I think it's good to spread the word about, like you said, spread the word about the detriments behind using lead ammo, and then let people make their own decision rather than telling them what they need to do. I think that's a really important concept to keep in the back of your mind. Other than that, thanks for coming on. This is a really good conversation.
Yeah.
Corey, you got any last thoughts for us?
I wouldn't say I'm close-minded to try and non-lead ammo. It's just it hasn't really come up until relatively recently, you know, with Heavy Shot donating the bismuth, and my wife mentioning it to me, seeing something and mentioning about non-lead ammo. So, you know, I guess I'm more, and after this conversation, I'm more open-minded to it. It's just I got to work through all of my other ammo first before I start buying the non-lead stuff. But thanks for coming on, Leland. I appreciate it. It was a good conversation, a lot of good information. So hopefully we can get you back on.
Yeah, and I'll echo what these guys said. Thanks for making the time, Leland, and definitely sorry we couldn't chat with Chris. To me, like the lead-free, the thoughts and ideas around lead-free are definitely growing, and you know, as you hear the rumors sort of dispelled and the conversations had, and I appreciate the chats with very educated folks like Leland and Chris, and they present some good, solid evidence that's backed by science, which when you debate things like these, oftentimes some of the folks that push back don't have that sort of scientific background or support to argue otherwise, and it sort of waters down both sides of it. When you just have two people that know a little bit about something trying to argue a lot about something, it doesn't really make sense. But the more I sort of think about it and the more I wrap my head around it, the more I'm like, you know what, I definitely need to be more conscious. And it went back to sort of what we were talking about at the very beginning of like being good stewards and understanding your impact beyond just that single animal. And, you know, as a hunter, I don't want to hurt an animal beyond like what I need to do to harvest it. Like, I don't want to see detrimental effects. I don't like shooting animals with younger that have, you know, cubs or fawns or anything like that, for the undue hardship it creates. Same thing when you think about scavengers and other animals that are feeding on it. And we didn't get to touch on it, but I want to have another podcast on it about the food consumption side from a human perspective in lead. Like, there is not a lot of support out there that shows it, but there is some. And I think we need to grab those folks and have some conversations and start thinking holistically about this too. You know, there's a lot of, as Leland mentioned, personal choice when it comes to the consumption side of from a human standpoint. But I think education is good. You don't know what you don't know. So with that, I appreciate the time that they both gave us this evening. And for everybody else out there, think about lead-free. Dig in, research, make a good decision that you support, by the way. But with that, be sure to make sure you're following Non-Lead Partnership over on social media. When you're done there, make sure you're following us at Harvesting Nature. Lots of cool things going on, as I mentioned at the very beginning of the show. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, punch that 5-star button, leave us a review, tell us we're doing right, or, you know, tell us we're doing wrong. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.